So, couple of administrative things. They have put up a homework, as I had indicated last time. It's due next week. Another project will be given out and will be due before the midterm. And the midterm is going to be mid-November. I'll announce the date next time. I'm going to get a room. Most likely it will be the classroom that's adjacent to here. Yes, once I confirm that we have the room, I'll announce the date. Okay. Alright, so let's continue our discussion from last time. So last time I started talking about two things. One was logical clock and the other was global state. So just to do a quick recap, the notion of logical clock allows you to reason about event ordering in a distributed system on machines where their physical clocks are not synchronized. Okay? So we assume that you do not need a clock synchronization algorithm, and yet you can use a notion of a logical clock and a timestamp that is assigned by the logical clock to reason about which event happened before which other event. Okay? Lamport's clock gives you the property that if event A happened before event B, the clock value assigned to event A is going to be strictly less than event B, that for event B. Vector clock gives you the reverse property as well. Okay, so if the timestamp of A is less than timestamp of B, then you know that A has happened before B. And the important thing to realize is when you have this notion of concurrent events, the timestamps will not be comparable. If the timestamps are comparable, there is an ordering between the events. That's the property to keep in mind. Okay? And then towards the end of last class, I started talking about this notion of a global state of a distributed system. And we basically said the global state of the system is basically the state, local state of each process, and the state of all the messages that are in transit. That captures the state of the entire system. And we looked at this distributed snapshot algorithm that allows you to capture global state. So I will do a very quick recap of that algorithm. Okay, so the basic point is, why do you need the distributed snapshot? If your system, if some process in the system crashes, you don't want to restart the system or restart the computation from the beginning, especially if this is a long running computation. You want to restart from a point that is close to where the crash occurred. To do this, you assume that each process can checkpoint its state, and you can restart that process from a checkpointed state. Okay? And you want the checkpointing to happen in a consistent fashion. Okay? And consistent fashion basically means that any message that was sent and processed already should not be resent. No message should be missed. And if a message is in transit, it should still get delivered. It will not be resent, but it should get delivered. And that's the reason you have to capture all of the messages that are in transit. They will not be resent by the restarted process, but you want them to be delivered to the recipient. So I talked about this algorithm which uses this notion of markers, okay, to capture all of the messages that are in transit. So the basic algorithm was one where any process can start a snapshot, and you do this, you checkpoint your memory state to disk, okay, and then you send out a snapshot message or a checkpoint message on all your outgoing channels. Okay, every process you talk to, you can say, please checkpoint. Once a process checkpoints, receives a checkpoint message, it will do two things. It will checkpoint its memory state, and it will start recording all the messages that are coming in. Okay? Basically, those are the messages in transit that have arrived after the checkpoint was taken, but haven't yet been processed by this application. Okay? And you stop recording when you receive checkpoint messages on all of your incoming channels. Okay? That's the algorithm. Now the issue is there are two things. One is, why will this algorithm finish or terminate? Shouldn't have an infinite loop. Okay? That is simple, because you will receive a checkpoint message on each channel exactly once. Because the first time you receive the checkpoint message, you send it out on all outgoing channels. If you receive subsequent checkpoint messages from other neighbors, you ignore that checkpoint because you already started one. Okay? This ensures that you will not keep sending checkpoint messages. You will only send it once on all your outgoing channels, and hence the algorithm will terminate. Okay? I also give some intuition as to why this message is that you are recording are precisely the messages in transit. Okay? If you have any questions on that, I can explain again. I don't know if you have actually, any of you have gone back and looked at the algorithm and have questions. Is there anything I can or should explain from last time? Okay. So we will revisit the snapshots in the context of termination detection. So the whole algorithm we will repeat, but for a different purpose. Okay. So distributed snapshot allows you to capture the state of a distributed system, so you can restart that computation. Okay. You can use the same algorithm for a different reason. Okay. And that is what is called termination detection. Okay. Termination detection simply is the problem of finding out whether all processes in the system have finished a computation. Okay. So assume that this is a distributed simulation of processes. Processes do some local computation, and whenever they receive a message, they do some other computation based on the contents of the message. Okay. And you want to ask whether all processes have finished. Okay. By finished, we don't mean that the process stopped. So we want to just say, is all the computation in the system done? Have all messages been processed? That's the question we want to ask. Okay. So how do you do this? Yes.
Just follow, you ask people what you've done.
Yes, of course, it's a simple thing. You have to ask all the processes whether they are done. Right? So that, but you have to do this in a reasonable way so that you don't flood the system and so on. So what we assume is we will use our snapshot algorithm, but now we will use it in a different way. Okay, any process can start this or kick off the algorithm, okay, which is going to effectively poll everyone saying, are you done or not? Okay. So, if a process P wants to start off this termination detection algorithm, it will send a message on all its outgoing channels saying, are you done? Okay. So, that's basically what's called a done message. Okay. Whenever a process receives a message, okay, what it will do is it will figure out whether it is itself done or not. And it also has the responsibility of figuring out whether its neighbors are done or not. Okay. So two things. So when you receive a message saying, are you done? You're not only supposed to answer based on whether you are yourself done, you need to also poll your neighbors and figure out whether they're done. Because those neighbors may not be directly connected to the process that started the computation. Okay, so we can assume that this is an arbitrary graph that connects these processes. Okay. So you send out messages to your neighbors saying, are you done? So you recursively do this. So each process does the same thing. So then you wait for all the responses from your neighbors. If all your neighbors say they are done, okay, then you know that the subtree that is sort of connected to your neighbor, they are all done. And if you are done, then you send a message back to your parents saying, I am done and everybody I am connected to is done. Okay, and this repeats. On the other hand, if any one of your neighbor comes back and says, I am not done, or you are not done, then you send a what is called I am not done message, which is called a continue message. Okay. So if anyone says they are not done, so this is basically the polling approach, but you are polling in using a tree. Okay, so there is no figure here. So let me draw one. So this is some arbitrary graph. Let's say this process starts off the computation. It sends done messages here, just asking, are you done? This process, when it receives a done message, checks whether it is itself done. Okay? And by done, we mean, are there any messages that it has not yet processed? Real messages. If it has work to do, then it has not. It's not done. Okay? So it will check this, and it will also send done messages to its children. Okay? And it will wait for a response. The children do this recursively. Okay. So eventually these are the leaves, so these might say either done or continue. So if you receive both done messages here and this one is done, you send a done back to your parent. If you receive any at least one continue, you have to say continue, meaning we are not done. Okay. And the important thing is this process receives two done messages. Okay. The one that it receives first is the path along which it is going to reply. Yeah, otherwise you will flood the network. So you will basically you may not reply along this path saying that that's my parent because that's the first time I received it. Okay? So essentially you are overlaying this tree that is polling all the processes and you figure out whether you are done or not. If any one process is not done, then you know that the computation cannot terminate. it's going to continue. This is your question.
So what happens to the other node because it's not received the done message or the finished message?
So the done message could cache it and send it up there.
Yes. So what you are going to do is you are going to reply, but you are not going to poll again. That's the point I was trying to make.
So you're going to reply to all.
You are going to reply to all the done message, but the first done message is one that triggers additional messages to your neighbors.
Okay.
Additional done message, you just wait for the first the response to this done message to appear.
Okay,
that's all. Yes, you have a question there.
So this could take a while. So what if one of the people start having competition again while it's still coming back?
Well, so question is, this might take a while. What if somebody starts a computation while this is happening? Good question. So let's think about what might happen. So the statement that I made, and when is the computation done? A computation is done if there are no more messages to process. Okay? And we will assume that when a process, a message arrives, you will do some computation and that computation will trigger additional messages. Okay? This is how a distributed system works. When you are doing some local computation, there is some communication based on what you are computing and what messages come to you, some other messages may get triggered.
So no new messages will come in.
So if everybody says they are done, what does that mean? There is no message that they want to send and they have processed all of their messages. That's what done means. Okay? So by definition, if everybody has said done, it means that all processes are finished processing their messages and they don't intend to send any other messages. So it cannot be the case that after you say done, you will actually receive a message. Or somebody will asynchronously send a message. Okay. This is a closed system. It's not an application like a web application where somebody sends a request. So that's not what we are talking about. Think of it as a distributed simulation where processes are just computing, exchanging messages, doing other computation. There's no external input. So all we are asking is, does any of these processes have to send any more messages to some other process, or are there messages it has itself not processed? That's what we are looking for. Okay? Is this clear? Any questions on this? Okay. So the next problem we are going to look at is what is called leader election. Okay. And the basic problem of electing a leader is one where you want some process in your distributed system, it doesn't matter which process, to take on the role of a coordinator. Okay. And you want to pick one and exactly one process to be the coordinator, and everybody has to agree who the coordinator is. Okay. In other words, the application developer is not going to say a priori saying this process is going to be the coordinator. You want to dynamically elect a coordinator. The reason for this is we assume that there may be crashes in the system. Okay, so if you have a priori designated a process as the coordinator, that process crashes, then the coordinator is gone. It will not be able to do what it was supposed to do. So you want a system that is going to adapt to process failures. Okay, so you want to elect coordinators dynamically. If some process goes down, you elect a new one. Okay. So in the period where the election is going on, there won't be a coordinator, but eventually the system will elect a new coordinator and things will go back to normal. Okay. So that's the problem of leader election. Yeah, so now where do you need coordinators? We have already seen the Berkeley clock synchronization algorithm where there was a master process that was acting as the time server. Okay. That was the process that was basically polling all other processes for their clock values and resynchronizing them. Okay? So you can assume that the master process was elected, okay? Not something that somebody designated. And if that master went down, somebody else could take over that role. Okay? There are many, many scenarios where this is necessary. Okay? You want somebody to be a coordinator. We'll see several algorithms today once you're done leader election where you assume there is a coordinator, for instance. So we look at two types of leader election algorithm, what's called a Boolean algorithm and a ring algorithm. Okay, let's start with the Boolean algorithm. So in all of these algorithms, we'll assume that processes are numbered. Okay, they have a unique numeric ID. Okay, and so each process knows its ID and processes' process IDs are unique. Okay, Okay. How you assign the ID is orthogonal, doesn't matter really. But assume that processes have been numbered somewhere. Okay. So process, we also assume that processes know their own IDs and the address of every other process. Okay. Assume also that communication is reliable. Okay. So for instance, you can use TCP and assume that communication is reliable. Okay. So the basic idea in the Boolean algorithm is you will always pick the process with the highest ID that is still alive as the leader. Okay, you could do the lowest, doesn't matter, pick either the highest one or the one the lowest one. As processes crash, you need to now determine which is the process with the highest numeric ID that is still alive in the system and make that process the leader. Okay. Then the question is, how do you figure out which process has the highest ID? Okay, that is basically going to be the leader election algorithm itself. So it's a form of polling. Again, the only way to find out is to poll and see who is alive, and then from that say this is the process with the highest ID and elect that as the leader. Okay, but the algorithm has to now figure out and everyone has to agree. Okay. So here is how it works. So any process can initiate an election. Okay, and it initiates an election if it itself recovered from a failure. Okay, which means it doesn't know who the leader is. A process just recovered from a failure. You don't know what has happened while the process was down. You don't know who is the leader. Okay, so you can start a leader election. Okay, because it has recovered, the leader might change. It may be the process with the highest ID in the system at that point. So if you start the leader election, you will know who is the process with the highest ID. It may be you or it may be the process that's the current leader. Okay. So you can start an election if you recover from a failure, or you can start an election if the current coordinator is not responding to you. Okay. So for any reason, if you detect that the current coordinator has stopped responding, the coordinator may have failed, let's start an election. Okay. So election can begin at any time. More than one election can be in progress concurrently. It shouldn't affect the results. But for now, let's assume there's one election. Some process has initiated an election. There are three types of messages in the system. Okay. There's an election message, there's an OK message, and there is an I1 message. Okay. And we'll see what they mean. Okay. So any process can start an election. Then the way you do this is you send election messages to all processes that have a higher ID than you. Okay. So you know that processes are numbered 0 through N. If you are process I, okay, you have to probe if there are any processes that have an ID higher than you, if they are alive. Okay? If not, you know you are the only process with the highest ID. Okay? So the way you do this is you send an election message to only processes with higher ID. There is no point polling a process with lower ID when you know you are alive. So then nobody that has an ID lower than you will get elected. So you only send this election message to processes with higher IDs. Then you wait for responses. Okay? And two types of responses might come back from any process that's alive that has an ID higher than you. An OK message or an I1 message. Okay. An OK message just tells you that process is alive. Okay. And when you know that process is alive, you know that you are not going to win the election, so you drop out. Okay. So if a process receives an election message from another process that has an ID lower than you just send it an OK message. Yes, and then you start an election yourself. So you say, you have to now detect whether you are the process. So this is recursive. Okay. And the process will continue until you basically hit the node with the highest numeric ID, and that is the one that is going to win. Okay. And if you win the election, then you send I1 messages to everyone in the system declaring yourself to be the new coordinator in the system. I'll show an example. Okay, so as to how this works. So we'll assume that there are 7-8 processes in the system numbered 0 through 7. Okay. 7 used to be the coordinator, but it has crashed. Okay. Node 4 at some point realizes that the coordinator is not responding. Okay. So it starts off an election, starts off the election algorithm, and it has to send an election message to all nodes which have a higher ID. So it will send an election message to 5, 6 and 7. Okay. 7 has crashed, so it's not going to respond, but 5 and 6 are alive. As soon as 5 receives the message, okay, from 4, it knows that it has the higher ID than 4, so it will send it an OK message. 6 is going to do the same thing. Okay. So this will cause 4 to drop out. So if 4 knows that there is at least one process that has an ID higher than it. So it will drop out and wait for the results of the election. So you figure it out, find a coordinator and just tell me. That's what 4 is going to do. So it's just going to drop out. So 5 and 6 will themselves start elections at this point. Okay? Because each of them needs to know who is the process with the highest ID. Okay? So this is the election that 5 has started. So it sends a message to 6 and it sends a message to 7. Okay? 6 has also started an election, so it is going to send a message to 7. Okay? Now as far as 5 is concerned, 6 is going to respond to it with an OK message. Okay? And as far as 6 is concerned, 7 will not respond to it. Okay? So 6 will know that there is no process 7 that's alive in the system. Okay, so it will actually declare itself to be the coordinate. It does not receive any OK message. You do not receive OK messages from all processes that have IDs higher than you, then you declare yourself to be the coordinate. Okay? So what will happen in the next step is, 6 is going to send an OK message to the election that 5 started, cause 5 to drop out, and since it probed 7 and 7 didn't respond to it, it will declare itself the coordinator and send an I1 or a coordination message to everyone. At this point, 6 becomes the new leader. Okay, yes, question there.
So this is a little redundant, because in 4 it sees OK messages back from 5 and 6, it knows 6 is the one who's going to win.
Yes, so this is... So you are saying, is it redundant when 4 knew that 5 and 6 were alive, 4, it knows that 6 is going to win. That is true. Okay. This is an so we'll look at that another algorithm that basically looks at that. And so it's not 4's job to elect the leader. You declare yourself to be the leader. Okay. So you could have 4 could have gone back and told 6 you are the process with the highest ID. But this recursively reaches the same result. Okay. What you said we will see in what the ring algorithm, that's essentially what happens. You just poll everyone and then you see who is alive and declare that process to be the leader. Okay. There's a question there somewhere.
Yeah, 4 started the election because 7 was not responding, right?
Yeah.
Then why does it send the election machine again to 7, the first
step? Okay, that's a good point. So 4 has started an election because 7 was not responding. So why should it send a message to 7? Yes, it may be rebooting. Okay.
But so in that case, then there is a possibility in the other changes that 7 will come up.
Yes, so everyone is probing 7 for that precisely that reason. Okay. If 7 does not respond until the end of the election, 6 will declare itself the leader. This is why I said when a process, any process initiates an election, if the coordinator has failed or if it has itself recovered from a failure. So at some later point, after 6 actually declares itself the leader here, 7 might restart. Okay? And that's why whenever you restart, you should start an election just to be safe. Okay? So in this case, 7 will restart the election and in this it is going to win because there is no other process higher than it. And it will take over. It will basically cause 6 to drop out and become the new leader. Okay, yes, question then. Yes. So that's a good question. So 4 is the first process that detected the coordinator had failed, it started an election. So any process can start an election, multiple elections can be in progress. Okay? So in particular, 0 may also detect the same thing and it may also start the election. So the same process will continue. But in the end, both will result in the same node becoming the leader, which is 6. Okay? So you just want the result to be consistent. Each is an independent election. Each will process exactly like this. Okay? And in both will cause 6 to win. Okay? And the first one that causes 6 to win, it will send a coordinate I1 message. And the second one, the leader does not change at that point. It still stays the same. Yes.
So if one node goes down, everyone realizes that you can start n elections in parallel.
Yes, if one node goes down, n elections may start in parallel. Yes. So you can, so you could do things like once you detected the leader has failed, pick a random number and wait for this random amount of time, just to prevent everyone from starting elections. So in the meantime, if you actually hear some election message from someone else, you don't have to start an election. So you could do something like this, but it doesn't matter. You can have that. That's what was mentioned in the slide, saying several processes can initiate an election simultaneously. All you want is the result to be consistent. You don't want different election messages, different elections to elect different leaders. So long as no other process crashes, you should have the same end result. If some process crashes during the midst of an election, then that's a different issue. Okay. Yes.
If number 4 starts an election,
and it reaches to the conclusion that 6 is the coordinator.
Hmm.
But by that time, if 2 also starts an election, will that election continue?
All elections, once you start, have to continue. They have to declare a result. You don't stop the election algorithm. Anyone can start, and that will go to its logical end, which is going to elect 6 as the leader. Okay. And multiple elections can choose the same leader. That's fine. Okay. Once you've chosen the leader doesn't change. There's nothing new to do in the system. Yes.
How does 6 know that 7 is down and not just taking a while to respond?
Yes, that's a good question. So question is, how does 6 know that 7 is either down rather than being slow? Okay. This is actually an important problem in a distributed system. Okay. You can never detect the difference between a failed node and a slow node. Okay. Typically, that's the short answer is you are going to use a timeout value. Okay. But the point I am trying to make is the timeout value can be arbitrary and the node can be arbitrarily slow. So in no distributed system can you just by pooling detect the difference between a slow node and a failed node. Because I mean you will, let's say you pick a 1 minute timer, the node may be 7 may be heavily overloaded, it takes 1 minute and 1 second to respond. So in this case, if it has really failed, it is never going to respond, so the timeout is fine. But if it is really slow, then you may have this problem that eventually you will receive a response. So that's the issue.
Does pooling take place only if a node is like the main node is down, or is like on a period does pooling take place?
No, election will start if you detect that the coordinator has failed, which maybe it has become arbitrarily slow and is not responding, so you don't know, so you start an election. Okay, so that's the way it works. So if it is really, really slow, it will never respond to any of these messages. 6 will become the leader, it will send I1 messages to everyone. And then 7 can at that point restart its own election if it feels that it is still functioning. It can start the election and then it will become the leader again.
Yeah, because if the node is slower but it still receives a message from 6 telling that it has won.
Yep.
And 7 knows that its ID is greater than 6. So it can actually broadcast that, no, I am still alive, right?
Yes. So does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay. Yes, you have another question.
So, if a process crashes, then everyone would get an okay message and everyone would drop out and no one would actually become a leader?
No, what's the question? So if the process crashes?
Let's say 7 sends an okay message, right? The 7 is going to become a leader. Then 7 crashes.
Yes.
Everyone has dropped out but no one has been elected.
Yes.
Do you have to restart the election or what happens in that case?
Yeah, so you can always restart the election if the coordinator is not responding to you. You can arbitrarily start elections at any time.
But if no one said I won, so you're still in the middle of election. The election hasn't ended.
Yes, so you could. That's a good point. So the point is, what happens if there's a crash during an election? That's basically your point. So essentially 7 has been elected, or rather that, let's forget 7. Let's assume it has really crashed. So this thing has elected 6. But okay, so 6 caused everyone to drop out, but 6 itself crashed before it sent out these messages. So it basically, election progressed until this point. Everyone has dropped out. 6 has won. But before it declares it has won, it crashed. So election does not finish. Okay, what do you do then?
So people still think that they're in the middle of the election, but no one is saying I won.
Yes. So you can arbitrarily restart. And if the election does not, again, it's a question of using some timeout value. If the election does not declare a result, and the old coordinator is still not functioning, you can restart the election. And maybe say if 6 really crashed in the meantime, someone else will win. Okay? Okay, so that is the Boolean algorithm. The reason it's called a Boolean algorithm is higher nodes with higher ID essentially are bullying nodes with lower ID and causing them to drop out of the election. That's why it's called a Boolean algorithm. So here is another one called ring based. Yeah, this basically goes to that earlier observation saying you don't need to recursively poll, you need to poll everyone just once. Okay? And just detect which is the node with the highest ID and declare that node to be the leader. Okay? So this algorithm is implemented using a logical ring. We'll assume that processes are again have unique IDs. Okay? And they are basically for the election algorithm, they use a logical ring topology. In a logical ring topology, node I will only talk to node I minus 1 and I plus 1, the node that has the ID lower than it and a node that has an ID higher than it. Okay? Just for the purpose of leader election. For the application, any node may talk to any other node. But for the election algorithm, you only talk to the node with the ID lower or and higher than it. So we'll assume that processes know their neighbor. Okay. So again, anyone can start an election, and basically you do start an election if you just recovered from a crash or the coordinator has failed. Okay. And what you do is you basically send an election message to the closest downstream node that is alive. Okay. So if you are I, you send a message to I plus 1. If for some reason I plus 1 was the node that crashed or is not responding, you do I plus 2. You probe sequentially until you find a node that is alive and you send it an election message. Okay, that's what it says. So sequentially poll its successor until a live node is found, and then you hand the election message to that node. Okay. And then this process, and that message also has you tag your ID onto the message. You append your ID to the message and you send. Okay, so this message is going to circulate through this ring. Each process is going to put its ID on the message and it's going to come back to the node that started the election. It's a ring, so it will circulate and come back. So what you get back is essentially a list of all the nodes that are alive. Because every node that has piggybacked its ID is a node that is alive. Okay? So then you just look at all of the nodes that are alive, pick the one that was the highest ID, declare that to be the coordinate. Same thing that was mentioned earlier. So then you send out a I1 message, or rather a coordinator message with an ID, and tell everyone who won. Okay, so here is basically the same scenario. Yes, 7 has crashed, but now you have all the same processes that are interacting using a token ring. Okay, so what happens in this case is 2 and 5, both of them start the election at the same time. Again, you can have multiple elections and they have to yield the same result. Okay. So 5 starts an election, it appends its own ID, sends it to 6. 6 tries to probe 7. 7 is not responding, so that's why it says no response. It goes to the next higher node in the ring, which is in this case 0, is a wraparound. So it puts its own ID. Okay, so you have 5, 6, and that goes there. Then 0 appends, and this is going to circulate. And all IDs except 7 will come back on this message. Okay, back to 5. At that point, 5 knows that 6 is the node with the highest ID. So it will circulate another message that will flow through the ring saying 6 is the new coordinator. So everyone gets to know who the new coordinator is or what the election result is. And 2 has started to say another election independently, and that will continue concurrently and is going to end up with the same result. If no other process crashes or restarts, okay, while this election is in progress, it's going to have the same effect. Okay, so what the point being, both election or any number of elections may be in progress concurrently. So long as there are no additional failures or restart, they will all have the same end result, a consistent result. Same node gets elected. Okay. Quick comparison. If you have n processes and you are assuming one election, okay, in the Boolean algorithm, and by comparison we mean how many messages are being exchanged in order to elect a leader. So in the worst case, you may have order n square messages. Okay? Because in the worst case is where the initiator of the election is the node with the lowest ID. Okay? If 0 starts off an election, in the Boolean case, 0 is going to send messages to everyone. Okay? Everyone will tell it, okay. Okay. And then 0 drops it. Then 1 will start an election, 2 will start an election, and so on. Okay? So you have order n square messages. If the best case is the node with the highest ID starts an election. So in this case, 6 is the one that detects that 7 has failed. It starts the election, it immediately wins. Okay, so there are only n minus 2 messages. Those are the I1 messages that go out. Okay, but there are no real election messages. There's no one to send to because 7 has crashed in this scenario. Okay, so you will be somewhere between the best case and the worst case for each election. Yeah, depending on who initiated it. In the ring case, you will always have 2 times n minus 1 messages. Okay, you have 2 messages that circulate through the ring, regardless of who starts it. Okay, the number of messages don't depend on the process ID. Okay, the first time the message goes around and picks up the IDs of all processes that are alive, the next time it circulates and declares the result. Okay, so 2 times n minus 1 messages. Is that clear? No question. How does it compare? How does it compare? Linear better than order n square in general, right? But we don't know who will start an election here. So that's why the best case you will be actually lower. Okay? The worst case you will be higher. The average case probably you will be higher. Okay? Because the average will be somewhere in between. Any questions? Yes.
Are there any zero-like algorithms that take into account the characteristics of each node? So say the node's resources or network type policies.
Yes, that's a good question. So question is, are there leader election algorithms that look at the node's resources? So I'll talk about electing leaders in peer-to-peer networks. So when you have this notion of super peers, you do take that into account. Okay? In this case, you don't. We are just assuming every node is equal. Every node has sufficient resources to serve as the leader in addition to doing its computation. Okay? So we are agnostic of node resources, but that is an important problem. Okay, for many systems, you do want nodes that are more capable, especially the coordinator has to do a lot of work. So you have to take that into account as well. So we'll talk about that in just a couple of slides. Okay. So here is another algorithm to do leader election. It has similar ideas as the previous two, except that this works in a wireless environment. Okay. Specifically in an ad hoc wireless environment. So this is actually described in the book, but if you look at what the book says, the algorithm was actually designed by a graduate student here in this department several years ago. It's now popular in this scenarios, okay, using wireless network, using leader election in wireless network. So we'll assume there's some arbitrary topology for your ad hoc network. Okay? And the topology tells you which nodes are neighbors to which other node. The important problem here is that a node may not be able to communicate with several other nodes depending on the range of the wireless interface you are using. Okay, some of these nodes may be far enough that if this node tries to talk directly, you cannot. Okay. So you can only talk to nodes that are within range. Okay. But assume that the node as a whole, the network as a whole is connected. You can talk to nodes over multiple hops, but may not be able to talk to them directly. Okay? And yet you want everyone to communicate with one another and elect a leader. So what is shown here is what you do is you overlay a tree structure onto this graph. Okay? And then you basically send back election messages backwards to the node that initiated it and you declare a result. Okay. So the way it would work is if 4 is the one that's starting an election, it sends a message to 6 and 4 and the link indicates that you are reachable. Okay. So 4 is within range of 6 and within, why is there 2 4s here? Not 4, sorry, there are A, B, C are the labels. 6 are the node capacity, I take that back. So A and B and I guess A, B and J are within range of one another. So A is going to initiate this election. So here you have node capacity. So you can do exactly what you are saying. You can look at the resources while electing a leader. Okay. So you broadcast out a message saying I want to start an election, and then B is going to send a message to C and G and so on and so forth until you have this topology. Okay. So what everyone has sent back to you, okay, is their capacities and their node IDs. Okay. So at this point, what you will do is you will say, is there a child? So this is a tree. Okay, the dark links indicate a tree. So each node will wait for all the messages from its children, okay, and do two things. Saying, is there a node in my subtree that has a resource higher than me? Okay. If so, you say that node has more resources, it's a better leader than I am because it has more capacity. So you do the same thing and you find a node with the highest capacity in the network and declare it to be the leader. Okay, rather than a node with the highest ID, you have probed everyone to find a node with the highest capacity. Okay. If there are multiple nodes with the same capacity, pick one at random, doesn't matter. Okay. So what will happen is this messages will flow up the tree. At each point you will figure out which is the node in your subtree that has the highest capacity. You send saying this is the node with the highest capacity, send that to your parent. And then you will pick at the root the node with the highest. So messages that are filtering back are the results of the elections in your subtree. Okay. And each subtree is trying to detect the node with the highest capacity. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So the same problem of finding nodes with higher or large amounts of resources also arises in peer-to-peer system. Okay. So if you remember, fairly early on, we talked about peer-to-peer systems that are structured and unstructured. Okay. And we said there will be in unstructured systems, okay, because messages get flooded, every node that is participating in this P2P system is going to receive lots and lots of messages. Okay. So for instance, you may send a query message saying, do you have this file, this music file? Okay. This will basically flood the whole network. Okay. Even if you don't have this file, you will get lots of messages and you have to respond to them. That increases the burden on nodes. Okay. So we said a better way to handle this is to have this notion of super peers. So for each group of peers, you elect one node to be your leader. Okay? And that leader knows about all of your content. Okay? So all query messages only hit the leader and don't hit all of the nodes. So this leader is designated as the entity that is going to respond on behalf of all the peers. So it takes over the burden of responding to query messages. Okay. This will reduce the burden on individual peers. So if you are on a low bandwidth link, you are not going to be flooded with hundreds of messages arriving every minute, just wasting your bandwidth, really wasting your network resources. Okay. So this how ends up with the same problem of how do you select who is a super peer? How do you elect this node that has that's going to respond on your behalf. So what you want are the following properties. You want to, within each group, okay, you want to pick a node as your leader such that you are well connected to the leader. You should have low latency access. You don't want to be connected to a leader that is far away from you. Okay. You want super peers to be evenly distributed in your network. Okay. You don't want the super peers to be clustered. You want them to be distributed. Okay. And you want some number of nodes to be super peer relative to the size of the network. As the size grows, you want the number of super peers to grow logarithmically. Let's say every node can be, a super peer can service 100 nodes. Okay. Every time 100 new nodes join the network, you want one more super peer to get elected. Okay. So that there's a constant number of super peers relative to the size of the network. Okay. And each super peer, as I said, should not serve more than a fixed number of nodes, to keep the burden on that super peer limited. So you don't want to overburden it. So you want an election algorithm that will meet all of those properties. Okay. So there are several such election algorithms. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of details. Here is one such algorithm that I can talk about, but the book actually talks about several others. Okay. It talks about electing super peer based on the node IDs, for instance. So you use nodes with high order bits as one and you elect them as super peers. Okay. This allows you to uniformly distribute nodes in the network as super peers, but it does not take the resources on the nodes into account when electing a super peer. Any node can become a super peer just based on the ID. Okay, so you can do something like mod 10, for instance. Okay. Every node that is basically has something mod 10 equals 0 is elected the super peer. Okay, or mod 100. So if you end up being node with ID 10, 20, 30, 40, all of those become super peers, for instance. Okay. That's a uniform scheme, but it does not take resources into account. So you want to do both, essentially. Okay. Here is another technique that also tries to, this is sort of, I'll explain what this is, but this will also look at uniform distribution of super peers, but does not take the resources into account. Okay. As I said, you really need to do both, but the two techniques that are in the book actually only satisfy one of the properties, which is that they're evenly distributed. They don't elect super peers that have more resources than others. Okay. Practical systems do take that into account. So Skype, for instance, okay, is essentially a P2P network. Okay. And Skype also uses super peers to figure out which nodes are up and which. So as soon as you log in, your super peer gets to know that you are logged in. Okay. Everybody who is connected to you, has you in their subscription list, will actually see that now you are logged in. Okay. Okay, that's because that super peer will tell everyone who is connected to you that you're logged in and your status changes. So this is all done in a P2P fashion. But Skype does take into account the resources on a node. If you are logged in from, let's say, your cell phone, okay, which may have a Skype app, you don't want this to become a super peer. Okay? And there will be lots of messages coming to you over a low bandwidth cellular connection. On the other hand, if you are on a high speed LAN, okay, and you are machine that's idle, let's say, you can become a super peer because it has more resources. So taking that into account is important, which none of these algorithms do. But that aside, let's look at the second one as to what it does. So here what is being done is you are randomly electing nodes as super peers. Okay, so how do you do that? So we'll assume that this P2P network is a graph. Okay, you are going to essentially throw some tokens into the network. Okay, and these tokens are going to move around. And when they stop moving, the node that they basically stop at is elected as the super peer. Okay. So how question is, how should they move around so that you get a property that the tokens become evenly circulated in the network? The number of tokens tells you how many nodes you are going to elect as super peers. Okay. And what this shows is that basically it uses a sort of analogy. Saying you can have a token that is either attractive, uses a attractive or repulsive force. So for instance, here there are three nodes, A, B and C. They all have a token. So what happens is, if there are two tokens close to one another, they repel each other. Okay? So what this does is, in the equilibrium state, each token is at a point that is equidistant from all other tokens, because if it gets any closer, it gets repelled back. Okay. This is sort of a very intuitive explanation of what the algorithm does. Okay, so assume that you have this network. Okay. So you just drop some tokens at random nodes. So let's assume you drop a token. Token comes here, here and here, or maybe here. Okay. So you will assume that tokens can repel each other. Okay, if the token, two tokens are close to one another, they'll repel. So these two tokens are close. So let's say this token pushes this token away. Okay. So this token may actually arrive here. Okay, let's assume that. Okay. So this token has arrived here. So this token is, the other token was here. So this will repel it. So this will go here. Okay. At this point, you're fairly balanced in the network because each super peer is at least two nodes away. Okay. So if there are more, so if there are any skewed distribution of tokens, they will start repelling each other until they settle into an equilibrium state. And those are precisely the nodes that are all equidistant, and that it allows you uniform distribution. That's the intuition behind the algorithm. Okay. Look at the book for more details. I'm not going to go into a lot more detail here. But there are some interesting additional ideas as to how you will implement this algorithm in practice. What does this repulsion mean in terms of when you implement a leader election algorithm? Okay, but that's the basic idea behind how do you do election in large scale system. The important point, the other important point being made here is, you are not electing a single leader, because this is a large scale system. You are electing multiple leaders, multiple super peers. In our previous leader election algorithm, we elected one and only one leader. Okay. Here the system is so large that you need multiple coordinators. So you want more of them. Okay. You want them to be evenly spread out in your system and so on. Okay. That's the difference between the first class and the second class of algorithms. Any questions on this? Okay. So the last problem that we'll talk about is distributed synchronization. Okay. So this is basically the problem of implementing the notion of a lock in a distributed system. Okay. So we know what a lock is in a centralized system. So if you have, let's say, a threaded application, this application has multiple threads that may access a global data structure. You want to protect this data structure with a lock. Okay, that provides mutually exclusive access to this data structure. Okay, so you have critical sections and only one process can be in a critical section. Okay. Now consider the same case, but assume that processes are distributed on multiple machines. Okay? And there's a shared resource in your distributed system that multiple processes want to access. But we want to enforce the property that only one process can access this resource at any given time. Okay? And if one process is accessing the resource, some other process has to wait until that resource is released. Exactly what a log does, but now all the processes are distributed on different machines. The resource is also remote. So how do you implement or extend this notion of a log to a distributed system? That's basically the problem. So how do you do this in a distributed system? Processes are running on multiple machines. So we will now look at two locking mechanisms, a centralized mechanism and a distributed mechanism. Okay. So in the centralized mechanism, again we will assume processes are numbered, okay, 1 through n, okay, and we will assume that you will use leader election to elect a coordinator. This coordinator is going to determine whether the lock is free or is in use and is going to cause other processes to block. This is the coordinator node. This node basically is the one that grants the locks to everyone. Okay, we already know how to do leader election. So we will assume that you have elected a leader using some leader election algorithm. So the problem, approach is as follows. Every process that needs to access the shared resource needs to first grab the lock. Okay? To grab the lock, you basically send a message to the coordinator saying, I want the lock. Okay? At some point in time, the coordinator is going to tell you, you can have the lock. Okay? Until then, you are blocked. Okay? Once the process tells you, you can have, the coordinator tells you, you can have the lock, you know you are the only process in the system that has access to this resource. You can do whatever you want with it. And then you can release the lock when you are done. Okay? And you release it by sending a message back to the coordinator that you are done. Okay? So the basic problem is, or the basic solution is very simple. To get exclusive access, you send a request and you block waiting for a reply. Okay? And the coordinator is going to have a list of all of the processes that have requested the lock. It's granting them the lock one at a time, means in some order, let's say it's 5-4 order. And when you are done, you release. Okay? The coordinator end, what you do is, you, whenever you get a request for the lock, you check whether the resource is currently in use or is it free. If it is free, then you can immediately grant that lock to the process that requested it. If some process already holds the lock, then you will block this request. Okay, you will basically hold it in a queue, wait for the lock to be released. Okay, once it is released, then you will grant the lock. Okay, that's basically what is shown here. Okay, your process is 0, 1, 2 and 3. 3 has been chosen the coordinator for the lock. Okay. Initially, the resource is available, so the queue is empty. One requests the lock, there's nobody who has asked for it, so it immediately gets the resource. Okay. So now, while one is still accessing the shared resource, two has also sent a request. Okay. And then, since one already holds it, this request is queued up, and you don't send a reply here. Okay. At some later point in time, one is going to release the lock, so you look at the queue, take the first process that is waiting, and send it an OK message and so on. Okay, very simple coordination mechanism. Yes.
So the shared resource must exist on some machine, right?
The shared resource must exist on some machine, yes.
So why not just have a lock on the machine that holds the shared resource?
Yes. Question is, why can you not have the lock on the machine that holds the resource? You can certainly do that. Okay. This basically is, it does assume though that the resource need not be a process. It could be a file, for instance. Okay. So this is more fault tolerant. Though if a process crashes, somebody else can still allow you access to a remote file. You could have put a designated process on the machine guarding the resource, and that becomes the coordinator. The question is, what will happen if that process crashes? This just allows you to continue to grant access to the resource by electing a new leader. That's the only thing. Other than that, there is no difference. Okay, you could just pick a process or you can elect a process. The algorithm is still going to remain the same. You will have to basically request the resource explicitly and wait for a grant or an OK message. That part doesn't change. All that changes is, how do you decide who is the coordinator? Statically determined or elected? Any questions on this? Yes.
What do you do when one crashes before it releases the lock?
Yes. So we'll talk about that. So what are the properties of this algorithm? So, first of all, it simulates a centralized lock with blocking call. Okay. Processes are distributed, okay, but now you basically get the same property. that if you request a lock, you will block until the lock is given to you. This is exactly what happens on a centralized lock. If you have a lock in a threaded application, you do lock dot acquire, you will block until the lock is released. Semantics don't change even though this is a distributed implementation of a lock. Okay? That's a good thing. Okay? It is fair because requests are granted the lock in the order in which they are received. You are using a FIFO queue. So you basically grant the lock in the order in which you are receiving request. So in fairness is ensured. So no one is going to starve or wait forever. Okay. It is also simple because it's using three messages for the use of a critical section. Protocol is fairly simple. Okay, the shortcoming are is a point of single point of failure. Okay. Coordinator can crash. Okay. You can of course restart start a leader election, elect a new coordinator. But there are some problems. Okay. If a new coordinator basically gets elected, it doesn't know the state of the resource. If some other process holds it or not, is not known. Okay? You don't want to grant the lock twice. Yeah, that's a problem. Okay? Even more bigger problem is what happens if a process that holds a lock crashes and the lock never gets released. Coordinator is fine. If process asks for the lock, you get the lock and you crash. You never release the lock. Then what happens? So there are these two problems. What happens if a coordinator crashes? How do you know the state of the resource? Is it available or is it in use? And if it is in use, who holds the lock? That is not known. Okay. Second problem is if somebody is holding the lock crashes, okay, then the lock is never released. All other processes will wait forever. You are deadlock in the system. Okay. Yes, question.
If you like a ping system, like you could say, if you haven't heard from the coordinator giving the lock, you ping it to make sure it's still alive. And right. The coordinator pings the one who holds the lock to make sure it's still alive.
Yes. So that's a solution, and basically the solution requires pooling in either case. Okay. So if let's take the example of a process that holds the lock crashes. Okay, how do you detect it? The way you can actually get around this is you can actually grant a lock with an expiration time rather than granting a lock forever. Okay. So if some process gets a lock, you say you have the lock for 30 seconds. At the end of 30 seconds, you will actually have to explicitly, the coordinator and this process have to explicitly communicate and see if this you should give it an extension. So if it's still using it and the process is alive, you can say, okay, you have it for another 30 seconds. So you keep doing this. So long as the process is alive, it can keep hold the lock for an arbitrary period of time. But the coordinator is constantly checking, is the process alive? Should it be granted another 30 seconds? If the process crashes at some point, okay, and the coordinator checks and sees that there is no response, you can wait for at most 30 seconds. At that point, you know that the expiration time has passed. Okay. So you don't need to worry about this anymore, and you can assume the lock has been revoked. Okay, because it's the client's responsibility in this case that every 30 seconds, the lock has to be renewed. Otherwise, the lock is going to go back. So if there's a crash, at the end of 30 seconds, you wait for at most 30 seconds and the lock basically goes back to the coordinator. This is one way to implement or handle crashes. Okay. And in the case of the coordinator, you can do the same thing. Okay. If a new coordinator, coordinator crashes, you elect a new one. Okay. You can do one of two things. You can poll all other processes asking them if they hold the lock. Okay. And recreate the state of the system when the old coordinator crashes. If nobody has held the lock, then it only means one thing, or actually it means two things. It means either that the lock was free, or it says that the process, the old coordinator was the one that held the lock. And now that process is crashed, so then the lock can come back to you. Okay, conceptually. The only thing to keep in mind is this does not guarantee consistency of the shared resource. Okay? The process was modifying a data structure and in the midst of this modification it crashed. The lock comes back to you but the data structure may be in a corrupt state because it's in the middle of being modified. Maybe it's a linked list, you are inserting an element and you crashed. Okay, now that you cannot recreate, but the lock state can be recreated. Okay. Okay, so that is the centralized algorithm. Here's a decentralized algorithm. This algorithm uses voting. Okay, so assume that every process, okay, has a thread that is going to do lock management. Okay. If some process wants the lock, it is going to broadcast a message to all other processes, not just the coordinator. Asks everyone, can I have the lock? So long as the majority of those processes tell you that you can have the lock. Okay? So you are voting, is the lock in use or available? So long as the majority of the process tell you that you can have the lock, you go ahead. Okay? That's basically the idea. Yes, now here is again some analysis that says what happens if the coordinator crashes and you forget the previous votes. You don't know what you voted for. Okay? So there's a certain probability value associated with it. M choose K, P is the probability that you sort of have voted yes, so P to the power K1 minus P to the power M minus K. Okay. So let's not worry about the probability itself, but we have to worry about what you need to do to reset the correctness property. What do you need to do to recreate the state of what the system was? So here the point that is being made is you need at least 2M minus N processes to tell you that the lock was in free or in use, in order for you to figure out what happened. Okay, one coordinator crashes, you can broadcast this message to all other processes and you can vote on the results. Okay, and you need at least 2M minus N of them to match for you to know what has happened. So this is majority voting. If the majority of them say this is what had happened, then you know what the, whether the lock was in use or not. So I want to do one more algorithm, then we'll compare them all of them. So this is also an algorithm that is decentralized or distributed. Okay? And this is going to use event ordering and timestamps to figure out who gets the lock. Okay? Again, it's fully distributed, no coordinator. Okay? So you are going to use event ordering. So basically it's going to assume total ordering of events in your system using multicasting of Lamport's clock messages, and I'll talk more about that in just a moment. Let's finish the algorithm. So let's assume process K wants to either enter a critical section or grab a lock. What does it do? It will increment its own timestamp. This is an integer, it's Lamport's clock. Okay. So it is going to increment it, and it is going to send a request, broadcast a request saying, I am process K, this is my Lamport's clock value, I want the lock. It's going to broadcast this to all other processes. Okay? And it is going to wait for reply messages. A reply message is essentially an okay from all of those processes. Okay? If all processes tell it go ahead, okay, then you basically go ahead and grab the lock. Okay? And if otherwise you wait, then you have to wait for everyone to tell you that it's fine to get the lock. Okay? Now, when do you say okay and when do you not? If you are a process that is receiving a request message. Okay, so if you have received a request message and you are process J, you will send a reply if there is no contention. If you are not interested in the lock, you don't care. You say go ahead. Okay. The only issue comes when there is contention, saying this process has sent you a request message saying it wants, it's interested in grabbing the lock, and you also want to grab the lock. Then you have to determine which one gets to go first. Is it clear what I just said? I haven't said how you did break this tie, but is the question clear as to what we are trying to do? If you have received a message from some other process saying it wants to grab the lock, you will send an okay message if you don't care. If you don't want to grab the lock, there's no contention, things are fine from your perspective. Okay? Now, if you are already in a critical section, if you are already grabbed the lock, you don't reply. You queue the request and you say okay after you exit at the critical section. So if you already hold the lock, you'll just queue this message so that other process is blocked. If you are not entered the critical section, but you are also contending for the lock, so you are also want the lock, this other process wants to want the, you want to determine an ordering, saying which one gets to go first. And the way you do this is you just compare the timestamp values. If your process's case timestamp value is less than yours, okay, this says that that event, that request event has actually happened before this request event. Okay. So that means that process made the request before you. So in fairness, you have to allow that process to go first. Okay, so you are basically just using timestamps to reason about who made the request first. Okay, by comparing timestamps, we know you can say whether A happened before B or not. Okay, because everything is broadcast, this is going to give you a total ordering. So all timestamps are always comparable. There are no concurrent events in the system. So you just compare the timestamp. If the timestamp of the other process is lower than your timestamp, you know that process made the request before you. You will send it a reply message Okay? Let it go first. Otherwise, you queue the message and you try to grab the lock first. Okay? If everyone else replies to you, then you will get the lock. Okay? Yes, question. Sorry, what is the question? Okay, so question is, where are the timestamp generators? So these are Lamport's clock. Timestamp is basically a Lamport clock value. As I said last time, these are integers. Okay? The clock value is incremented upon every event. So each event gets a timestamp, which is the integer clock value that you are using. Okay, so that's what you use. Yes, question.
So what if your artisan is okay, then you realize they actually want the lock, so you want to say, oh, I want to...
So, once you have replied, so if you have a request and you already replied, if you have no contention, then you are done. And at some later point, if you want the log, you will yourself send request messages to everyone else. Because like everyone, you have to implement the same algorithm. You have to ask everyone, and when everyone says fine, then you can. So if you have granted the log, that's fine. You will just start a new request. You will wait for replies. That's the way it would work. Is this clear? What has happened? If the timestamps are equal, so what do? So you can use the process ID to break that. Okay, so you, if the two timestamps are equal, then you will essentially use the process ID. Typically, that should not happen if you are using something like a vector clock, for instance. You cannot have equal timestamps because it will have to be either less than or greater than, but not equal. Because equal timestamp means it's the same event. Events cannot have the same timestamps. Lamport's clock, that can happen. Okay. So this algorithm is also called the Rickard and Agarwal algorithm, based on the people who propose it first. And the interesting thing here is you need two n minus one messages. Okay. For election to not election, for the lock to be granted. Because you basically broadcast a request message to n minus 1 processes, you wait for reply message from those n minus 1 processes. So after you exchange 2n minus 1 processes, 2n minus 1 messages, you are guaranteed to get the lock. Okay. It might take an arbitrary amount of time to get all reply messages. Okay. Because some process may be holding the lock, so it may wait for until it's done before it sends you a reply. But you are guaranteed that you will actually get a reply so long as there are no failures. Okay. Now let's do failure analysis. So this is just the algorithm.
If any node fails, the project, you can't get a lock.
Yes. So good thing about the algorithm, fully decentralized. Bad thing about the algorithm, now there are n points of failure. Okay. In the centralized case, there was a single point of failure. If that coordinator crashed, there was a problem. Here there are n points of failure. Any process crashes, because you have to wait for all n minus 1 replies before you know that none of these other processes want the lock. Okay. You cannot proceed without it. Okay. So if some process crashes and it does not reply, you don't know whether that process is holding the lock and hence it's not replying, or whether it has crashed and therefore it is not going to reply to you. So you cannot distinguish between these two states. Okay. So, you have made the algorithm worse in the process of making it distributed than the centralized case. Okay. This is, in general, when you go from a centralized to a decentralized algorithm, things typically get better in terms of failure resiliency. Okay. Because you have multiple processes and the state gets distributed. The resilience of the system is higher. There is no single point of failure. This is one of those rare instances where algorithm, the distributed algorithm, has worse failure case in properties than a centralized one. Okay. There is nothing you can do to change it. It's just the property of the algorithm. Because okay. The other problem is all processes are involved in all decisions. This will cause overloading. Okay. Even if you are a process that never wants the law, you still have to process all request messages and send replies saying, yes, go ahead. And basically in a centralized case, only the coordinator is responsible for doing it. Here every process is doing the job of the coordinator, essentially. Even if you don't care about the lock at all. So there are these two problems with the algorithm, yes.
I don't see the benefit of distributed lock over just the machine that has the resource having lock. Because if you crash, Then it doesn't matter because no one can access your resource anyways.
So the resource is a centralized resource. You are just guarding one resource. It doesn't matter where it is. Okay. So it's the resource may be, let's say, a file somewhere on a central storage. All processes are coordinating access to the file, and you want to ensure that only one process gets access to the file. So it is not the, always the case that if a process crashes, the resource becomes unavailable. Because the resource is decoupled from the algorithm. Where the resource is located has nothing to do with the algorithm itself. Right? Each resource has to have a separate log. Okay, that's the thing to keep in mind. Any questions here? Okay, so last algorithm that I'm going to talk about, and I think we'll finish in 2 minutes, is a token ring algorithm. Yeah, again, your processes numbered 1 through n, they will be arranged in a logical token ring. Okay? In this case, you don't have to explicitly, this is the nice thing about this algorithm, is that you don't have to explicitly request a lock. Okay? Every so often, you will be given an opportunity to grab the lock. And at that point, you have to decide whether you want the lock or you don't want the lock. If you don't want it, you basically don't acquire it, you just send it to someone else. And the way this works is, the reason it's called a token ring is, there's this notion of a token. This is a special packet that is going to keep circulating. Okay? In order to grab the lock, you have to wait for the token to come to you. If you have the token, you are guaranteed that only you have the token, so you can do whatever you want with the shared resource. Once you're done accessing the shared resource, you send the token to the next process. Okay? So the token keeps circulating in the ring. Any process that wants to grab the lock has to just wait. It doesn't do anything. It just waits. The token will eventually come to it. Okay? Since there is only one token in the system, the process that holds the token is guaranteed that it's the only one that has the token, and it has exclusive access to the resource. Okay? So it can hold the token as long as it wants. It can do whatever access it wants on the resource. And then once it's done, it just sends the token to the next process. And now the next process gets access to the lock. The next process doesn't want the lock, it will just send it on. But if it wants it, then it will hold it and do whatever it wants and then send it on. This is the very simple idea behind this algorithm called the token ring algorithm. Is this clear what the algorithm is? Now the interesting thing about this algorithm is it was actually designed for a local area network. Okay, so back in the old days, there were two competing technologies for LAN. It was Ethernet, which was a broadcast-based thing, broadcast-based LAN, and there was a token ring algorithm. So the assumption was here is all these machines that are sitting on this broadcast medium. Okay? You want only one of them to transmit a packet at any given time. If two nodes transmit, their packets are going to collide. Okay? And the question is, how do you grant access? So these are machines and this could be basically a LAN. How do you ensure that only one node in this network transmits a packet at any given time? Okay? And you want to guarantee that. So the way they address this was you basically circulate a token, and as a token circulate, each node gets to transmit packets. Okay. So you just wait for the token to come to you, then you know it's your turn to send whatever packets you want to send to whichever node you want to send it. Reception is no problem, it's only the sending issue. Only one node can send because it's a broadcast-based medium. Think of a similar scenario in a wireless network. Okay, you basically have laptops that are talking to the access point. You want only one laptop to broadcast, because if two laptops broadcast a packet, they are going to collide. Okay, and then it will be garbled and nothing is going to go through. Okay? So you can implement the same algorithm in a wireless network by having a token that circulates. When you get a token, you transmit. Okay? So there were LANs that were built using this technology, but for whatever reason, Ethernet became more successful, so this technology essentially died. Okay? But the concept is still alive in the, and that's the notion of how are you using this notion of a ring to implement mutual exclusion. And the way you do this, you have this special packet called a token. It circulates, and the process that has the token is the one that gets the lock. Okay? There are some interesting issues here which I did not talk about, which is basically how do you detect the loss of a token. If a machine holds a token, let's say it's a PC, and it holds a node and it crashes while it's holding the token, then what happens? This token has disappeared. It hasn't passed it on. Okay? So you need a token regeneration algorithm. You need to figure out that the token has gotten lost. You need to regenerate that token. Okay. And you want to ensure that always that only there's exactly one token or no more than one token in your network. If two tokens get generated, that's a problem because now two processes can transmit. It's essentially giving the lock to two processes. The token regeneration is very important too. You want to guarantee that the token gets regenerated. You want to guarantee it will get regenerated. You also want to guarantee only one token gets regenerated. So you have to detect the loss of a token, regenerate it, and so on. So that we can discuss next time because we have run out of time. But basically the algorithm itself is very simple. Okay? No message exchange, nothing. You just wait and yes, eventually a token will come to you, you get the lock. So that's the basic thing. So let's stop here. We will sort of just finish up next time. So just a reminder for those of you who came late, there's a homework that I put up last time. It's on the web page. It's due next week. So just make sure you turn it in. We'll use the usual Spark-based submission process. Okay. Oh, the other thing is, has the solution come on the mailing list for the first homework?
No.
All right. So I have sent it twice. For some reason, it's not going out. I have to see why. I think there may be an issue with the attachment size or something like that. If it doesn't go out another time, I will hand out hard copies of the solution. Okay, so I realized that for some reason this email is not going out to the mails class mailing list.
You can put the attachment on the EdLab server in the direction we can all access.
I can do that. I can just put it on the web page also.
I actually APKB. I also try to send.
Oh, is that why it is not going out?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I'll have to look at what to do. Okay. Thanks.